This programme was previously broadcast live on Love Sport Radio, so some items may be out of date. For more podcasts or to listen live, visit lovesportradio.com.
This is the Premier League Fan Show with me, Kieran Critchard, between 1 and 2 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up over the next hour, we'll be reacting to the last game of the Premier League weekend as Aston Villa ran out 2-0 winners at home against Newcastle. Jack Grealish impressing. Could he really be good enough to play for the Big Six already? We'll be looking ahead to tonight's Champions League action. Jose Mourinho takes charge of his first home game and Champions League game of Tottenham as they host Olympiacos, knowing a win will secure qualification into the knockout stages. Manchester City are in action against Shakhtar, knowing as long as they don't win, they will qualify as well. We'll also be talking a bit about Arsenal later in the hour. When will Unai Emery be sacked? I don't think it's a case of if he's sacked. I think it's a case of when. Who will be the man to replace him, and how much longer will Unai Emery last at the Emirates? Remember, if you want to get in touch with us this afternoon, call us on 0208 7020 558 or WhatsApp us on that very same number. This is the Premier League Fan Show here on Love Sport. So that number again, 0208 7020 558, if you want to share your views on your club, not just talking about Aston Villa's win against Newcastle last night, not just talking about the Champions League or about Arsenal. If any fan of any Premier League club wants to get in touch, call us on that number. You can WhatsApp us or get us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Love Sport Radio as well. So plenty to go through in the next hour. Let's start off by looking back at last night's Premier League game, the final one of the Premier League weekend. It was at Villa Park on the Monday night football, and it saw Aston Villa win by 2-0, which means Villa are now 4 points above the relegation zone. Goals from Conor Hourihan, a well-worked free kick, and also Anwar El Ghazi coming from a Hourihan free kick, gave Aston Villa all 3 points. An impressive performance by Jack Grealish, who said after the game, actually, that he would rather play in a number eight position rather than further forward, but certainly put in a pretty classy display. A lot of the papers this morning waxing lyrical about Jack Grealish's performance. He has been fouled 46 times this season, 7 more than any other player in the Premier League. Read into that what you will. Not that the free kicks yesterday were incorrect decisions, but maybe a little bit of a misleading statistic. The biggest takeaways from the game, Jack Grealish himself, the performance that he put in, kind of asked the question, how good is Jack Grealish? Because Jamie Carragher after the game was saying that he is a top player, that has the ability to play at the top level, seems to be a player that has time on the ball, and those are that's a sign of the best players. I wonder where Jack Grealish is. He was being rumoured that he could be involved in the England squad, but maybe injury prevented him from partaking in the England squad in November or in the international break this month. And you wonder where Jack Grealish goes. If he has a good season, he was linked, if you remember, in the last couple of seasons with a move to Tottenham. Maybe Spurs were priced out of a move for Jack Grealish. He stayed loyal to, obviously, his boyhood club. You wonder whether if he continues the form that he's shown in the early part of the season throughout, which clubs might go in for him? Is he ready to make that step up? I would say at this moment in time, no, that I don't think he is quite ready for a move to a Champions League side. I think you're going to have to see more consistency. I don't think you can say after a few months of this Premier League season that suddenly Grealish is a Champions League player. If he does this week in, week out over a whole season, then I think those questions can start to being asked. But at this moment in time, I don't think Jack Grealish is quite ready for that. But he certainly put in a pretty good display for Newcastle. They were looking for a third straight victory, the first time that would have been the case since November of last year. But a loss for Steve Bruce's side. It would have been an opportunity, actually, for them to put 8 points between themselves and the relegation zone. Questions being asked of Newcastle's front three. Alan Saint-Maximin is kind of still adjusting to life in the Premier League. Has shown glimpses of quality, and even last night showed a little bit of what he's capable of, but still kind of very raw in the Premier League. Joe Linton only has a handful of goals. He's potentially not had the service to him that that another striker may have, and therefore the view on Joe Linton, if he got more service, I think we'd have a different opinion on him. Miguel Almiron, who was bought in the January transfer window under Rafa Benitez for £20-25 million, yet to record a Premier League goal or an assist. Again, a player that's shown glimpses, but that's a pretty poor record between January and November. Not a single Premier League goal or an assist. And Newcastle spent big money on that front three. You think of Joe Linton was £45 million. Alan Saint-Maximin was about £20 million. So was Almiron. So you're thinking upwards of £80 million and not necessarily producing the numbers that Newcastle would have hoped for. It was an opportunity for them to put that gap between themselves and the relegation zone. But a good win for Aston Villa. It was always going to be tough for Newcastle away at Villa Park on a Monday night, and Villa getting a massive win after losing three straight games, granted against good opposition. They played Manchester City, Liverpool and Wolves. So three games where realistically Aston Villa probably didn't expect to take anything from those three games. Important to get back to winning ways, and their home form is going to be crucially important really this season. You look at a lot of those sides down in that relegation area, it's going to be massive for them, their home form in particular, because if they can rely upon getting a number of points at home, it takes the pressure off your away form. And what you don't want is heading into the second half of the season, your home form to be patchy as well as your away form. And suddenly when you play at home, you don't have the confidence of playing in front of your home crowd. Instead, it can become a burden. It can become a real pressure on you. So a big result for Aston Villa last night. They move up a few places and it pushes West Ham and Everton closer to the relegation zone. In the relegation zone at this moment in time, Watford are bottom on 8 points, Southampton just above on 9, Norwich on 10. Then it's West Ham just outside the relegation zone. They're 3 points clear of Norwich. Then you've got Everton and Aston Villa. So a lot of the talk over the last few days has been surrounding the futures of the likes of Manuel Pellegrini at West Ham, Marco Silva at Everton, and closing or getting closer and closer to that relegation zone will not help their cause either. So a big win for Aston Villa, 2-0, goals from Conor Hourihan and Anwar El Ghazi, who initially didn't really celebrate because I think he was a bit worried he may have been offside, but on that occasion he was onside, the goal stood. So a good win for Aston Villa last night. Obviously, Champions League is back tonight and tomorrow night. We've got Group A, B, C and D on today. In Group A, Galatasaray take on Club Brugge. Not necessarily a huge amount to pay for, but it could depend on the other game, which is Real Madrid, who host PSG. If you remember back to the opening game of the group stages, in that group, PSG smashed, annihilated Real Madrid at the Parc des Princes. So PSG cruising into the knockout stages. Real Madrid, though, there is a pressure on them. If they were to lose today, which, based on the way the group has gone, you'd say PSG favourites? I don't know whether you quite say that at the Bernabeu, but it seems like there are some real vulnerabilities within this Real Madrid side. If PSG were to go to Madrid tonight and win, that would potentially open the door for one of those other two sides to go into. An added narrative in this game tonight at the Bernabeu is surrounding the future of Kylian Mbappe. Supposedly, contract talks are underway, according to L'Equipe, but maybe Mbappe is looking for that move. He's always dreamed of that move to Real Madrid, and obviously that connection with Zinedine Zidane, a fellow Frenchman. Is it realistic that Real Madrid, could they afford it? I mean, how much are we talking? I think Mbappe's probably worth £350 million. I think maybe even more than that. If you're talking about a player you could potentially have for a decade, how good he already is and how good he could become as well. An added story to that. Interesting today, a report's coming out about Neymar. Some text messages that were exchanged between Lionel Messi and Neymar after Barcelona lost 4-0 at Anfield against Liverpool in the Champions League semi-finals. Messi was pleading with Neymar to come back to Barcelona, said he's only going to stay at Barcelona for a couple more years. So some interesting text messages that have been unveiled. In Group B, which is Tottenham's group, they host Olympiacos. It's Jose Mourinho's first home game in charge of Tottenham. It's also his first Champions League game in charge of Tottenham. They host Olympiacos, knowing that a win will seal qualification into the knockout stages. In the other game in the group, Bayern Munich, who've been running away with this group ever since it started, including that 7-2 win, which for many people, that was the start of the end for Mauricio Pochettino. That was really a crunch moment, that losing in that manner was maybe the first inkling that Daniel Levy was looking for a change. Bayern Munich travel to Serbia to take on Red Star Belgrade. Bayern Munich in full control. They're 12 points out of 12. Tottenham on 7 points. So a win for Spurs in Jose's first home game in charge of Tottenham will seal qualification. In Group C, Manchester City, the other English side in action tonight. They host Shakhtar Donetsk, knowing that if they avoid defeat, they will qualify. They've been in control of this group, although a pretty interesting one-all draw in Atalanta last time out, where Kyle Walker had to go in goal late on after Ederson went off injured and Claudio Bravo was sent off. But City at home against Shakhtar, they're without Sergio Aguero for the next few weeks. But you would expect City to easily beat Shakhtar, a team that they know pretty well. They've been in their group, I think, 3 of the last 4 years. So the two sides know each other pretty well. The other game in the group, Atalanta, we just mentioned, they are at home against Dinamo Zagreb. And finally, the final group in action tonight is Group D. Lokomotiv Moscow, played by Leverkusen, a game that really doesn't have that much of an influence on the group. That is one of the two early kickoffs at 5-6, along with the Galatasaray Club Brugge game. The other game is where the added interest is Juventus against Atletico Madrid. That will really go a long way to deciding who is going to finish top of that group. Also, this rift that is growing between Maurizio Sarri and Cristiano Ronaldo. A lot of talk about that. Sarri said the fact that a player like Ronaldo getting annoyed at coming off shows how motivated he still is, how hungry he is to succeed. You just wonder whether that rift will be an irreparable rift. And also, you'd imagine that if Juventus had to decide between Sarri and Ronaldo, I think it will be Ronaldo who they choose over Maurizio Sarri. So just a rundown of all those games tonight. In Group A, Galatasaray take on Club Brugge, Real Madrid take on Paris Saint-Germain. In Group B, Red Star Belgrade play Bayern Munich and Tottenham host Olympiacos. Group C, Atalanta play Dinamo Zagreb, Manchester City are at home against Shakhtar Donetsk. And in Group D, Lokomotiv Moscow played by Leverkusen and Juventus take on Atletico Madrid. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us this afternoon, share your views on the Champions League or the Premier League, call us on 0208 7020 558. We're on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram at Love Sport Radio. We are also on WhatsApp, so make sure you get in touch with us. We're going to be talking a bit about Tottenham later in the hour. Jose's first home game and first Champions League game in charge of Tottenham. We'll also talk about Arsenal. Unai Emery seemingly is on the way out, but how much longer will he last? But up next, we're going to be talking more, unfortunately, about VAR.
Love Sport.
This is the Premier League Fan Show with me, Kieran Critchard, up until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Remember, if you want to get in touch, call us on 0208 7020 558 or WhatsApp us on that very same number. Unfortunately, we thought at the beginning of the season that we wouldn't be sat here at the beginning of the week talking about refereeing decisions, but unfortunately, the joke that has been VAR this season means that we are in the exact same situation, if not a worse situation, than we were last year. There's been so much debate about inconsistency. One of the big things with VAR is the use or lack of use of the screen on the side and how it's just being used as a bit of decoration on the sidelines. We see in Europe all the time that when they go for a VAR referral, the referee goes over, because ultimately the decision rests with the referee on the field. And so he's the one that will receive the brunt of the criticism if it's wrong. He needs to be able to see that decision because he's the one that makes the original decision. So he thinks he's seen it, or in the case of most referees, they quite clearly don't see it. So they need to be the ones to go over to the sidelines and be able to see it again, because it shouldn't be seen as a weakness to change your mind having seen this again, because you might see it in full time in live action and think that's a penalty, but then you might, if you were then to look at it again, it shouldn't be a bad thing to say, actually, having seen it a couple of times again, seeing a couple of replays, I actually think differently about the decision because I didn't see that the attacker initiates the contact, or there isn't the contact that I thought there was in the first place. And that's one of the biggest problems. In Europe, we're seeing it, and there's a huge difference between the way that it's being done in the Champions League compared to the Premier League, to other leagues, the Bundesliga, Serie A, to the way it's being done in our league. And I just don't get the arrogance and the kind of vain nature of the referees, that they feel like they're above it and they don't need to have a look at it. It's all well and good having someone at Stockley Park looking at it for the VAR, But actually, the referee himself, who makes that initial decision and ultimately makes the final, well, does he make the final decision because he's being told what to do, that he needs to be able to go and see it and have a look at a couple of replays. It takes time anyway, so the referee might as well go and have a look at it to be able to make a full judgment himself, a much more kind of well-informed, well-educated decision on that moment. And I don't get, at the moment, there's no point in even having a screen there. It seems irrelevant. So the referees need to go and do that. But there's been so much debate, and it genuinely is rather concerning that, number one, that the situation is no better off than it was last season. If anything, it's slightly worse. And number two, this lack of awareness from the referees, from Mike Riley, from Neil Swarbrick, who's in charge of VAR training, that there's a lack of awareness that there is a massive problem. Neil Swarbrick said he'd give it a 7 out of 10. I mean, what planet are these people on that think that the referees and VAR are doing a good job? Everyone can quite clearly see it's an absolute mess. It's chaos at the moment. And if anything, it's worse than it was last season. We didn't even have the technology. That this is the concern, that with more technology, it doesn't seem like anything is massively improving. So there needs to be this understanding from the referees that there is a massive problem. And at the moment, they're in this deluded environment, a bit like Joe Root at the moment, this deluded environment that they think everything's okay. They're in this parallel universe where, in their world, VAR is working to absolute perfection and they're getting it right. The reality is that they'd be more apt, these referees, working in a circus than they are on a Premier League pitch at the moment, because they are utterly inept. And until they realise and accept that things aren't going well, even an acknowledgement from the referees to say, actually, it's not going brilliantly at the moment, but we are working hard to change it, that, I think, would help a little bit. But this arrogance, I think, from referees, that we can never make mistakes, we never make mistakes, and everything's hullabaloo in this parallel universe, is just only adding fuel to the fire and is only increasing the pressures on referees. Someone who always has pretty good views and is well informed on these issues, the former referee Keith Hackett. He joined Richard Lee and Patrick Christie's on the Breakfast Show this morning. Obviously, they were talking about the mess that is VAR, and they started with Crystal Palace's disallowed goal against Liverpool on the weekend.
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, a lot of discussion and debate about it. I think the difficulty is that we've seen over the last seasons, a few seasons, we've seen referees allowing grappling, holding, pushing to go unpunished. And then when we said you get a simple push, which it was, and it's penalised, we all sort of say, what's going off? I think it's down to referees to be consistent and punish where pushing takes place.
What I'm concerned about with that is, and I get that there was a nudge there, you can't get around that, but yeah, you look at the idea that Lovren goes down under that amount of pressure if he's actually defending, you know, in the, you know, say long ball over the top. I'm not sure he does, to be honest with you. And what I'm concerned about is the slow motion replays. Now, hear me out on this one, because that looked like a much worse push in slow motion than it did in real time. And I'm just worried that we're going to end up with a situation where every time a ball comes into the box, you just see like six lads just throw themselves onto the floor and you've got to pick through each one. Someone's getting a penalty. Someone's getting it every time.
I think you make a valid point. You know, I think that when we do slow things down, challenges, however they come, pushes over the top, various fouls, they all look 10 times worse. And I always remember watching rugby, and I think it was Nigel Owens in a game, televised game, where it looked as though a player was going to get a red card for a challenge. He came in with a shoulder. It looked pretty violent. In slow motion, it looked terrible. And then Nigel Owens just said, can I play that at normal speed? And it was played at normal speed. And he just turned and said, that's rugby. And I think to some degree, your point is absolutely valid. I think we've got to stop looking at these incidents in slow motion. Yeah. And get back to the reality of real time. And when you look at it in real time, for me, it's a push. But this is the difficulty of referees, because we've got players going to ground so easily now compared to in the past, that this is what makes life difficult for referees. And this is where one area where they get wrong from time to time. And we have a debate about opinion. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one for opinion. Some of my colleagues disagree with me and say, no, it's not a penalty. It's gone down too easy. And I'm in the middle of that debate.
One I have to talk to you about was the Sterling offside this week. And he actually put out quite a funny tweet. He says, I'm happy to improve my VAR overruled goals record again today. This thing's going to kill me. Again, it's so tight. And they showed the screenshot. And for me, I'm not sure. And we've actually spoke about this on the show before, about the fact that it's so hard to get this 100% accurate because you don't necessarily know the point underneath where the player is. I'm looking at this, and for me, that looks onside. I've actually got the picture in front of me now. For me, it looks onside. Yeah. I don't know your thoughts on this. It's so, so tight.
Well, I'm amazed that it was ruled out because it was onside. I am convinced it's onside. Yeah. And I'm also equally convinced that the technology that throws up the line and throws up the snaps that we see is inaccurate. It's not like goal line technology. I've said that before. The camera speeds at goal line technology are 500 frames per second. This is at 50. Mm. And we've got two datum points. We've got the guy who's passing the ball and then the guy who's receiving it. And there's time lost in the frames. Mm. So for me, the IFAB, the governing body, meet on December the 3rd in Dublin. And I hope that in their discussions, they will bring this to the fore and consider next season changing the law. Because I always, when I coach the referees and when I manage the referees at the Premier League level, I said any doubt, it goes to the attacking player. So in these situations, I believe on such tight calls that the attacking player should get the benefit of the doubt. We should enjoy goals.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. Keith, I'm just wondering, roughly speaking, how much are referees and linesmen paid in the Premier League?
I think they get close to 100,000 in terms of referees now, because, of course, they're full-time.
Mm. Yeah,
I mean, in my day, in the dark days of black and white TV, although it did turn and I did referee on the Premier League, we got between £20 and £35. I mean, when I refereed the FA Cup final 81, I got £35. No. And in fact, I refereed two games for £35 and, of course, a gold medal.
Flipping out. There you go, mate. Because I'm going somewhere with this. Because roughly speaking, again, how much does VAR cost? Because what I'm trying to gauge here is we seem to have a system where we're paying a lot of money to a robotic system that's getting it wrong. But could that be better spent at maybe having even just a couple more officials looking at a pitch side monitor?
I think you make a valid point. I think they've piled in. I mean, I'm still massively concerned that Mike Riley continues not to use the pitch side monitor. Someone sent me a photograph this week on Twitter, and there it was, wrapped up. It wasn't even prepared for a referee to go and have a look at. And so, for me, using the monitor is important. I think in terms of investment, where I'm really concerned is if you take this weekend, and look, I think he did really well. Andre Mariner had two VAR games on Saturday, and then went to Bramall Lane and did a terrific job in the Sheffield United, Manchester United game. So, the mental fatigue side of things worries me a little bit. But I think we have a dearth of talent. I think we're down to about five or six referees that are capable of giving us a reasonable performance. I think the rest are also rans and should be moved on.
Yeah, there's another interesting one. Ollie McBurney, of course, it went in his favour. There was a question whether it was a handball in the game against Manchester United. Funnily enough, on the Saturday morning, he tweeted, VAR is miles off, his scrap the whole thing. And it ends up working in his favour that evening. What did you think on that one? Because it does look, again, you freeze frame, and they spoke about if it touches your arm and a goal is scored from it, that it should be disallowed. It looks like it's touched his arm. And to me, it looks quite black and white if these are the rules.
Well, and I'm a Wednesday fan. Yeah. I think how it was left was this. I think that they took the view that it was that he couldn't actually make a decision. Mm. And because it wasn't clear and obvious, they stuck to the criteria of VAR and left it with the on-field decision. And I think that's how they got it to. I mean, the importance of that decision, the time pressure on the VAR, and the referee standing there waiting, it's immense, really. And I think that we could have a long discussion about hand and arm. And people asked me yesterday, where's the hand and arm? And of course, it's right up to the joint in the sleeve. So yeah. I think it's a decision that could have gone either way. And I think Chris Wilder must be very happy that on this occasion it went in his favour.
This is Love Sport.
This is the Premier League Fan Show with me, Kieran Critchard, up until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Obviously, at Arsenal, things not necessarily going brilliantly. Unai Emery hanging on by the smallest of the thinnest of threads. To talk all things Arsenal now, I'm delighted to say we're joined by Harry Simeon from the Chronicles of Aguna podcast. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Harry. Before we get on to Unai Emery, it's partly linked. Looking back at last weekend, a 2-2 draw at home against Southampton. Many thinking Arsenal were lucky to get a point. I think Tony Adams described the performance as embarrassing from Arsenal. Just kind of try to sum up what Saturday's game was like in the atmosphere at the Emirates, watching a display like that where Southampton, right near the bottom of the table, dominated that game.
Absolutely. It was a really strange atmosphere, actually, because it was almost as if there were Arsenal fans kind of wanting Southampton to finish off Unai Emery. And, you know, nobody will admit it. Nobody will come out and say they wanted their team to concede goals, etc. But there was that feeling amongst the stadium, amongst the Arsenal fans. You could feel that. You could feel that when Southampton, particularly when they were 2-1 up and they missed a host of chances to put the game to bed, there were people that actually wouldn't have minded those chances going in just because they so desperately want to see the back of Unai Emery. And that's the reality of where we are as a fan base at the moment. And it's sad because at no point should you ever want your team not to do well. But it just feels like we've given him enough time now. Things aren't getting any better. The performance on Saturday was as bad as I've seen under Unai Emery. And there have been some bad ones, but that was pretty poor. We're really, really fortunate to nick an equaliser right at the end. And you could tell by the lack of celebration that, you know, what people felt about it. Because ultimately, we'd nicked a point in a game that we had absolutely no right to get anything out of when you look at the balance of play. But it's just that there's this feeling now amongst the Arsenal fan base that we need to get Unai Emery out. This needs to come to an end, and so we can move on. Because at the moment, the disinterest that surrounded the club towards the end of Arsene Wenger's tenure is starting to creep back in.
I was going to ask you, Harry, about that goal, the equaliser in the 95th minute from Alexandre Lacazette, because it led me on to thinking, and obviously you've been very forthright in your opinions on Unai Emery, which is fair enough, and you're entitled to that, but it did strike me that at times it didn't look like the Arsenal players really cared. The lack of celebration was a feeling of, oh, maybe I was meant to sky that, because a loss against Southampton may have forced Arsenal's hand to sack Unai Emery. There were times during the game where David Luiz was running around the place like a headless chicken rather than actually trying to defend. For all your views on Unai Emery, and as I said, you're fully entitled to that, do you think there's a massive blame that should be directed at players? Because it feels like, at the moment, it's a typical end to a tenure for a manager where the players just seem disinterested and they feel like giving up and therefore not putting in 100% to keep the manager on board.
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, the players obviously have to take some accountability for everything that's gone on lately and the poor performances. And, you know, I highly doubt that the way they're performing is all Unai Emery's instructions. They're certainly not carrying out sort of his game plan to a T. He's defended his players constantly in press conferences and said, you know, they carried out my plan, or the work was good. He keeps saying that. But ultimately, you can see that this group of players do not want to play for Unai Emery anymore. They've down tools. It's clear. The lack of celebration, I wouldn't say it was because they didn't care. I would say it's more because this is a game against a team who were in, I think, 18th or 19th position before the game kicked off, who we should be walking all over at the Emirates Stadium. And it was almost as though we've equalised, but that's the very minimum. It's nothing to celebrate, which it isn't. Really, you know, when you look at the way we played and everything, it was a robbery, if you ask me. It was the Arsenal getting out of jail. And I believe that equaliser actually earned Unai Emery a little bit more time, because I think the board would have been under such immense pressure to pull the trigger on him had Arsenal lost that game. And I think he's gotten out of jail. The players are to blame as well. You know, there's no doubt about that. But you can't sack a playing squad of 22 players to make a change. You can't do that overnight. They're on contract. And it just doesn't work like that. With a manager, it's one person. So you can make that change with a lot more ease. And that's why the first person that everybody looks at is the manager. It's not to say the players are blameless in this. They're certainly not. They've had their part to play as well. But, you know, like I said, you can't just change your squad of players overnight, whereas you can change the manager.
One of the big criticisms, Harry, I've seen aimed at Unai Emery is the constant changes in formation, that it's seemingly one week it's a 4-2-3-1, sometimes it's a 4-4-2, sometimes it goes to a back three. It's just constant changes. Is that an example of why Unai Emery perhaps hasn't helped himself, that you have this philosophy, and granted at times you're going to make changes, you need to be flexible, but you surely have a philosophy in mind as to the formation, the style you want to play with? It just seems like Unai Emery's got a very cluttered mind and he doesn't really know how he really wants to play.
It's the actions of a man who's just desperate to turn things around, that he's so desperate that he's trying different things every week. At the end of the day, you can't have a plan B and a plan C if you don't have a plan A. And that's the problem with Unai Emery. You know, it's very easy to say, yeah, you need to be adaptable. And to a degree, I agree with that. But you should have a go-to way of playing. You should have a go-to philosophy that you tweak depending on your opponents, not a completely different philosophy every week. And that's what we're seeing. Last season, we started with a back four. Unai Emery very quickly changed that to a back three because he said that it gave us more defensive stability. At the end of last season, he came out and said that he preferred the back four. Started the season with a back four again, and lo and behold, we're in November and we're playing with a back three again. It is too much, you know, flip-flopping almost from Unai Emery. If he's not clear, if he doesn't fully believe in what he's doing, then how is he supposed to get the buy-in from the players? And that's the big issue. You know, I would have had a lot more respect for him if he came in, set a formation, and said, this is how we want to play, this is how we're going to do it, and we're going to have to ride the rough sometimes and get ourselves through it. A bit like Klopp did when he came to Liverpool. You know, you could see how he wanted to play. Didn't necessarily have the players to do that, and at the beginning, the results were up and down. But eventually, when he managed to get the players in that he needed, look at what they're doing now, because he stuck with his guns, he stuck with what he believed in. Unai Emery isn't doing that. And this is not the first time he's done that. If you speak to Valencia supporters in particular who don't have a very good relationship with Unai Emery, despite him doing actually quite well there, you'll hear the same things. You'll hear the flip-flopping, you'll hear the lack of identity, the negativity, all the same problems. And it's not his fault. It just, in my opinion, this job is just too big for him.
You mentioned, Harry, about how maybe that draw against Southampton has bought Unai Emery a bit more time. What do you think the Arsenal board are waiting for? Because we've now gone past the third international break. We are heading into the busiest part of the season where literally games come thick and fast. The January transfer window will approach faster and faster. It's 5 weeks away now. So why are they waiting when there are managers available out there that could potentially come in straight away? What do you think the Arsenal board are waiting for? Do you think that there's still a belief that he could succeed and that's why they're holding off from sacking him?
Well, based on what we're sort of hearing and sort of whispers that are coming out from the club, we understand that Unai Emery has a very good relationship with Raúl and Leahy at the moment at the top of the club, and he is fighting his case. He doesn't want Unai Emery to be sacked. He still believes that he's the right man to turn this around. And that's essentially what we're hearing is the problem at the moment and why nothing's been done. Arsenal were given Sunday and Monday off, which was quite interesting. Sunday, you expect it, given they played on Saturday. But to have Monday off kind of suggested that something was maybe going on and there were some meetings going on, given that we play on Thursday night as well. So we haven't heard anything yet. It looks like he will be in charge for the Eintracht Frankfurt game in the Europa League because we've not heard any different. But for me, I think there have to be some serious discussions going on now. And in answer to your question as to what they're waiting for, they're probably waiting for a situation where they don't have to pay him out, because that's how Arsenal operate. You know, there's a complete lack of ambition from the very top. It's all about money. It's all about finances. It's all about protecting their books. And we've done all this stuff in the summer about the We Care The You campaign. They released another statement the other day, putting pressure on the board again. But I don't think we're going to get anywhere with this. I think that at this moment in time, you know, Arsenal are not willing to sack Unai Emery, probably because A, Raúl thinks he's still the right man, and B, because they simply don't want to pay him off.
When, obviously, a manager is right on the edge, obviously, attention turns to who might replace the manager. So many different names have been thrown into the mix, whether Arsenal go down the former player link with Mikel Arteta, although Guardiola has said that he will not be leaving at any point this season. Then you go with an experienced serial winner in the form of Massimiliano Allegri, who's free after leaving Juventus. Even Mauricio Pochettino's name has been mentioned. Paul Merson has said that Arsenal should be going all in to secure Pochettino. If it were up to you, I think you said Allegri. What would be your views, though, Harry, on Mikel Arteta? If he were to return to Arsenal, having played for Arsenal during his playing days, would you be a fan of that, or would you be slightly worried about a man that obviously has been right-hand man to Pep Guardiola for the last few seasons, but doesn't have any experience of being a full-time manager?
I'd be a little bit worried because, you know, like you said, he's not had that experience as the number one, as the main man just yet. But if you're going to be the right-hand man to somebody, Pep Guardiola is probably the best person that you can learn from sort of in world football at the moment. So, you know, I don't doubt that Arteta probably has the quality and stuff to do the job. And then being an ex-Arsenal player, being even an ex-Arsenal captain for a little period of time, I'd be happy to see him come back to the club, and I'd support him and I'd back him. We all supported Unai Emery at the beginning, but you know, you're going to judge them on their merit. And you know, I don't believe that Arteta could do any worse than, you know, the way we're currently playing, simply because his footballing philosophy is very different to Unai Emery's. And it's a philosophy that fans are probably more willing to give more time to, because it is essentially, I guess, in many people's eyes, the right way to play football and an exciting way to play football. So you'd give that a little bit more time. At the moment, we're trying to be pragmatic. We're trying to be a little bit boring at times in the hope that it will improve us defensively, but it's not working. And we're not able to switch it up. We're not able to turn the quality back on like we used to in previous years. And it's a real concern. Arteta, for me, wouldn't be my number one choice. Like you said, I mentioned Allegri in the past. I want Arsenal to go out and make a statement and get a top, top football manager. But if it was Arteta, at this moment in time, I'd prefer him to Unai Emery, yeah.
And just finally, Harry, when I look at Arsenal and think where they are now to where they were 18 months ago, towards the end of Arsene Wenger's reign, I don't see Arsenal being better. If anything, I think they might be slightly worse. And the same problems that were there for many years towards the end of Wenger's reign are still there. Do Arsenal need a complete ripping up of everything and need to start again? Because the issues with Arsenal now are seemingly issues people maybe were even talking about even a decade ago.
Absolutely. The same problems have haunted us defensively. We've not been good enough. Unai Emery's come in the hope that he would improve that. He hasn't. For a number of reasons, not just through fault of his own, you know, the players that we've brought in, and we're led to believe that the recruitment is being handled by others at the club at the moment. They've not brought in the right people. But ultimately, you can change the manager, you can change a number of things. But the reason I'm so adamant that I want a high profile manager is because I want someone with that clout to walk into the boardroom and say, I don't want this player that you're putting on the table. I want my player who is X, Y, and Z, because that is what I believe will improve this team. And unless you go and get a top, top manager, I'm not saying I want Jose Mourinho, but someone of that ilk who has that experience, that winning record, who has the power to demand, then I don't think anything's going to change at Arsenal, because the lack of ambition comes from the very, very top. And it feels like they've put a team in place, a management team, to try and manage the club a little more closely. But ultimately, they're just relaxed because they're not under any pressure from the people above them to deliver. It's that simple. You know, unless the whole structure changes and, you know, a top commanding manager comes in, then I really, really can't see how, even if you push Unai Emery out the door, how we're going to improve dramatically.
Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, Harry. That was Harry Simeu from the Chronicles of a Gooner podcast. He's been very forthright in his opinions that Unai Emery isn't the right man, but there are much, much bigger underlying issues at Arsenal. And from the top down, there's serious change needed at Arsenal. Just one other line to bring you from the Premier League, and some news this afternoon coming in that Manchester City have begun initial negotiations with Raheem Sterling over a new contract which could make him the highest earner in the club's history. Supposedly positive initial discussions were held with Sterling's representatives on Monday. Supposedly the meeting in Manchester lasted just under an hour, with talks focusing on a deal which could catapult Sterling's £275,000 a week wages beyond the £350,000 a week deal signed by Kevin De Bruyne in January 2018. Obviously Real Madrid have been linked with Raheem Sterling, but the news is that City have begun initial negotiations with Raheem Sterling over a new contract. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us, call us on 0208 7020 558 or WhatsApp us on that very same number. Up next, we'll be going over to the other side of North London and talking all things Tottenham.
Love Sport.
This is the Premier League Fan Show with me, Kieran Critchard, up until 2 o'clock this afternoon. We were talking about the red part of North London. We're going to be talking about the white side of it now. And I'm delighted to say we're joined by Flav from the Fighting Cock. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Flav. Let's look back at Jose Mourinho's first game in charge. It was a 3-2 win away at West Ham. Tottenham raced into a 3-0 lead before being pegged back. Perhaps a nervy point to the end. What do you think you learned from Jose Mourinho? What were the early signs of Mourinho's reign, or is it far too early to be even asking that question?
Yeah, I mean, it is too early. Obviously, we can't take much from it. He's only had 2 days of the squad, but there was a massive change in the way the team played, the new formation, brought new ideas. The players were responsive. Dele Alli looked a bit more like what he did a couple of years ago. And, you know, it is too early, way too early to jump to any conclusions, but it was just complete, a different performance. He hadn't won away from home since January, and first game Mourinho is in charge, he gets us that win away, even though, as you say, it was a nervy ending towards the game.
You mentioned Dele Alli there, Flav. He seemed to be in good form on Saturday. Some people have been talking about the number of games he's already played at the young age of just 23. Do you think there's a risk that he's been overplayed as a young player, or do you think maybe he's lost a bit of drive? Because his form of the last 18 months is very different to where he was a couple of years ago.
Definitely. I hadn't thought about the number of games he played. He played 100 league games before he even arrived at Spurs, so he has played an insane amount of football for someone of his age. And, you know, he has dipped in form. You know, there might be a part of a little bit of wear and tear on his, like I said, on his kind of, as a young player playing so much football, there is some sort of wear and tear on him. But I just think that he was his form was a symptom of the things that were going wrong at Tottenham. I think his best position is behind the front man in that 10. And it's hard to kind of incorporate Eriksen and Dele Alli. They both kind of want to play there, and they're both most effective in that role. Obviously, with Mourinho's system and having Son stitch to the left and Moore on the right, it just gave Dele Alli the opportunity to focus on a very simple job, which was to find space and create chances. And I think it's, as much as you can tell from watching him on the game, it kind of seemed like Mourinho simplified it for him, just to go out there, you know, fulfill your roles and your duties defensively, but also be creative and express yourself. And, you know, you saw the backfill. That was the kind of stuff you were getting away with a couple of years ago. The pace at which he was running was impressive as well. He was obviously highly motivated. And, you know, if we can get him back to anywhere near where he was playing a couple of years ago, then it's only a good thing, because he has been a shadow of himself in the last 12 months, I would say.
You mentioned Christian Eriksen there. Obviously, he's yet to sign a new contract. There's been a lot of talk about him as to whether he is going to sign a new contract. He only played 10 minutes off the bench against West Ham. Do you think that Jose Mourinho's arrival will convince him to stay, or do you think his ambition to play, in particular probably in Spain, will be too much even though Mourinho's come in?
I think he's probably had enough. You know, he's been with us a long, long time, and he probably wants to see what else is out there, and I can completely understand it. It's one of those, he's been a servant for the football club, really, 7 or 8 years. So if he doesn't want to sign a new contract, he wants to move on, he can get a big deal wherever he goes, because he's going on a free transfer. You know, best of luck to him, really. I don't think Mourinho will attempt to convince him to stay if his heart's not in it. He would have started if his heart was in it, I'd have assumed at the weekend. Mourinho himself has said he needs to figure out what's going on inside Eriksen's head before he can be trusted to start. Out of the three, they're on a contract, kind of, at the end of their contract, with Sundgren, Alderweireld and Eriksen. I think Alderweireld is the most likely to stay. He's still, you know, has 2 or 3 years to stop to play, and I think he's motivated by what Mourinho's going to bring to the team and the club, and maybe he doesn't have to go anywhere else to achieve what he wants to.
In Jose Mourinho's press conference ahead of tonight's game in the Champions League against Olympiacos, he ruled out the signing of Zlatan Ibrahimovic, a reunion between the two. Do you think, even if it's not Zlatan Ibrahimovic, do you feel like Tottenham are in desperate need of someone else in that position? He talked about Harry Kane being one of the best strikers in the world. Why would he need someone like Zlatan Ibrahimovic in? But Harry Kane has had quite a few injuries the last few years. Is that a need in January that Tottenham need to fill?
It's a problem that's not really solvable. obviously signing Ibrahimovic would have been the wrong decision, because he comes in, he wants to start, and you know what an ego he is. He's not going to play second fiddle to Harry Kane, and we've already got a better striker in Harry Kane here already. So the question you're asking is, do we need to sign a backup striker? But who of any quality wants to come and not play? Like, how do you go about finding that person? It would cost to get a striker good enough for where Tottenham want to go, would cost us 50 million. And you know, spending 50 million for a backup to a striker isn't, it's not good business then. So I think it's about trusting the system. I mean, Pochettino did it rather successfully. And when we didn't have Kane, you know, Son and Lucas Moura sort of stood in. We've also got this very good young prospect in Troy Parrott. He's only 17, he's not ready, but he looks like he's going to go and have a very good career. So I think it's about trusting in what you've got and the youth that's there, rather than splashing £50 million when we need fullbacks.
And just finally then, Flav, obviously it's Jose Mourinho's first home game in charge, first Champions League game in charge of Spurs against Olympiacos tonight. Tottenham will qualify with a win. Are you confident that Tottenham will win tonight?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always confident. Olympiacos away from home have been pretty average. We should beat them. I mean, the new manager will bounce, still there. Mourinho's a great coach. He knows how to manage games. And, you know, if we lose this against Olympiacos, then the problem hasn't gone away at all. But yeah, I'm confident. I think Spurs will run out fairly relatively comfortable.
Thank you.
Thank
you very much for joining us this afternoon, Flav. That was Flav from the Fighting Cock on the move in London somewhere. So a busy day for Flav. But talking about Tottenham's game against Olympiacos tonight in the Champions League, Tottenham know that a win will secure qualification. Obviously, they're 5 points behind Bayern Munich, so Munich looking very strong to top the group, but Tottenham looking to qualify tonight. I asked Flav about the situation surrounding a striker that Jose ruled out a reunion with Zlatan Ibrahimovic, and Flav said it's the impossible task. But I look at another team in the Premier League in the form of Manchester City, and they've got two top quality strikers that Gabriel Jesus would get into most Premier League teams, and they've got two of them now. At times, maybe there's been suggestions there's not been quite the harmony that they would like. Aguero at times hasn't looked all too pleased. But if anything, Aguero's become a better player, actually, since Jesus' arrival, that he's got that bit better. He's been perhaps motivated or encouraged by Pep Guardiola to improve his all-round game, and he's gone on to another level, which is ridiculous for a player that was already a world-class player. But he's gone on to another level. He's had a few injuries, and that's been a trend in Sergio Aguero's career. But the City are an example of a side that have two, arguably, well, would you call Jesus a world-class striker? He's not far off it. He gets in most Premier League sides, and Aguero is a world-class striker. So that shows you can. I mean, I'd say that Aguero is a better player than Harry Kane. And so surely you'd be asking the question of City, well, how can you have a backup striker to Sergio Aguero? Well, City have proven that. Gabriel Jesus' record in the Premier League is actually phenomenal, his goal-scoring record. So I think that does show you can do it, and Tottenham do need, because Harry Kane has had injuries. If he does get injured, where do Tottenham go from there? So Tottenham involved in the Champions League against Olympiacos tonight. Manchester City plays Shakhtar Donetsk.
This is Love Sport.